Radio Rebell Podcast. Archivaufnahme vom September 2006. Thema und Überschrift: Interview mit Steve Harley, der am 17. März 2024 im Alter von 73 Jahren an Krebs gestorben ist. Frage an Steve Harley im September 2006. Es hat den Anschein, als würde die Zahl der Balladen mit jedem neuen Album zunehmen. Auf dem jüngsten Album The Quality of Mercy ist etwa die Hälfte der Songs als Balladen zu bezeichnen. Auf dem Album Poetic Justice von 1996 sind sogar 8 von 11 Songs ruhige, langsame Balladen. Wird Steve Harley mit wachsendem Alter musikalisch ruhiger, sensibler, sanfter?
How strange that you noticed that. Wow. It would never have occurred to me. I'm not going to give a reason, because I'd never ever considered the point, but a song is a song is a song. I don't know if I've ever written a true ballad in my life, apart from if you think of a ballad as something a balladeer, which is me, would perform. I suppose they are ballads, but then most songs are in their own way. But if you mean just a slow song or mid-tempo, geez, it would just never occur to me. As you get older, the writing process is slightly more difficult. It's to handle. When we're young, yeah, I think I've obviously mellowed to a degree, matured, obviously. I don't want to be the only teenager of 55 on the block. I mean, that's just, of course I'm matured now. I've got children of 20, 23. Yeah, and when I was 23, 22 even, and set out, gave up my proper job in the belief that I could I change the world through music, I didn't change the world, but you're young and idealistic. Yeah, you set out to acquire material goods, maybe not consciously, but you start to buy things because record companies send you royalty checks and you play concerts and you get paid, and suddenly you've got money you didn't know you would ever have. You didn't, in the 70s, we never did think like that. Most of us didn't, I don't think. So when you've got everything you want, as I have, or everything I need, I'm actually still very ambitious professionally, but my family is comfortable, will always be comfortable. So I've pretty well got everything I need, my family needs. Want is a different word, if obviously, but then it gets harder to write, because you're looking around the walls of your house and thinking, yeah, I love this. I love these paintings. I mean, art is one of my greatest passions, museums, painting, art in general. I'm in awe of great masterpieces, in awe. I stand before Van Gogh or Cézanne, or Stuttgart, where there's the museum there with this fantastic, unbelievable collection of German Impressionism. And to stand before them to me is awe-inspiring. I sometimes can't leave. And I've got nothing like that, but I've got wonderful art around my house. The walls are covered. And I've got the guitars I need, the piano I want, and I can eat anywhere I want and fly anywhere I want whenever I want, first class, and stay where I want. So I've acquired everything that a young man would set out to acquire when he's 22. I'm penniless, euroless, no euros in pocket. And then, you know, what do you write about? So if you're saying they are ballads and they're slightly more, less, they're less aggressive, it's probably true, but they are also written from the heart. And songs like A Friend for Life, you know, I had to be 52 or 53 years old before I could write that. You can't write that at 25. You can fall in love and you want to say to this woman, but how are you going to write at 25, you know, when the kids leave for breeding? And the TV's king, will you tell me we're not done yet? You're not going to think this emotion when the kids leave for breeding. You can only do that when you're looking at your own kids. and worried sick that you will have nothing more interesting in life to do than sit and watch TV. Well, that couldn't happen in my life, you see, because I'm just the travelling minstrel. I'm a wandering minstrel. I'm an inveterate traveller, an explorer. But the songs, you know, even if they're fairly produced, fairly laid back, if I choose to make the tempos fairly laid back or mid-tempo, then it doesn't detract, I hope, from the fact that there's a story in there and that I took the lyric very, very seriously. I throw a lot away, a lot in the bin, believe me. What I release, that's the best you're ever going to get from me.
In einem Interview aus dem Jahre 1976 sagte Steve Harley, seine großen Idole seien Schriftsteller und Dichter wie William S. Burroughs, Ernest Hemingway und T.S. Eliot. Jack Kerouac bedeute ihm mehr als etwa die Rolling Stones. Kann man daraus ableiten, dass der Text, die poetische Erzählung eines Songs für Steve Harley, wichtiger ist als die Musik?
Yeah, it would have to have a story of some sort to hold my attention, that's for sure. That's why I'm not good at the bubblegum. I can't help it. You know, we're all, hey, everyone's who they are, and I can't help that. I was educated in literature, and I'm in awe of great writers, obviously. I wouldn't today be able to put Kerouac above the Stones, no. Although he didn't write out of tune. I mean, you know, the Stones are phenomenal. It's the only word. It's phenomenal. A mix nearly as old as my dad. It's phenomenal. But I still want to know, with respect to the Stones, I want to know how Mick and Keith and Ronnie can walk out from the wings and hit a first chord of a show and be out of tune. I need someone to explain that to me, because we spend a lot of time in the wings tuning guitars. They come out and hit one big chord. Ooh, it's out. So that's amusing. I don't know. They're phenomenal. And Kerouac I've grown a bit tired of, but I wasn't out. I wasn't far out with that list. Hemingway changed the way people thought and the way they acted. T.S. Eliot changed the way poets presented their work. T.S. Eliot changed everything. Hemingway did it in say in the 20s, T.S. Eliot, in the 30s, Hemingway. In the 60s, the Beatles did it. It wasn't an author so much as pop music, you see. The Beatles changed the world. And then a minute later, along came Dylan, and Dylan changed the Beatles. This is how important he was. So I was lucky in that I was born in 1951. So I'm not a real baby boomer, and I wasn't a mod or a rocker. I was a little bit young for all that. But in the mid-60s, at 15 and 16, I had Zeppelin 1 and I had Revolver. And you don't get any better than that. Where do you go after that? The early Zeppelin and the Beatles mid-60s period, where do you go? Where you go is Springsteen came along with Born in the USA and Born to Run and stuff. You know, there's so much wonderful music made, wonderful. I shouldn't have said those names because the list is endless and I shouldn't name names. But the Beatles and Dylan obviously were, it was the period, period to be a teenager.
Man konnte auch lesen, dass Steve Harley in jungen Jahren von Motown-Soul-Künstlern wie Smokey Robinson beeinflusst wurde.
I mean, we had Motown too. My friends and I, what a period, man. We talk lyrics, you and I. Chuck Berry, a genius lyric writer in the 50s and 60s. What about Smokey? I mean, Smokey, you listen to I second that emotion, Tears of a Clown. I mean, it's just outrageous. Lyrical poetry, the narrative of Smokey's writing, again, like Chuck Berry, a relatively poor young black guy, how they found these beautiful poetical turns of phrase is beyond my comprehension, but they found it all right. And even I grew up falling in love. My first sex was to the Temptations, and Smokey wrote for the Temps, you know, and we went and saw the Temps and Lee Dorsey and all these great Stax and Motown acts in the mid to late 60s, my friends and I, as we were growing up and losing our virginity to Motown. What a period. Stax drums. Whoa. that rhythms, the whole rhythm section, and Carol, what's her name, at Motown playing bass, the woman, the housewife. She's the bass player on most of those hits. Steve Cropper, Duck Dun Don't. Oh, Knock on Wood. Dock of the Bay, Steve Cropper. I met him here about 10 years ago. I was playing in Kiel, North Germany, you know. And they were on the was on the bill just before the Blues Brothers, the real band, you know, with Eddie Floyd singing with them. And they did Knock on Wood, of course, which was Eddie's hit, wasn't it? And my German tour manager went along. It was a sports stadium. And I said, Steve Cropper's in the next dressing room. I mean, Steve Cropper, for heavens, you know. One of my few heroes in the music business. Yeah, she said, Patty Unwin, my wonderful English, but lived all her life in Germany, German tour manager. And she just went along, brought him back. Knock, knock. Yeah, she comes in with Steve Cropper. What a lovely man. And I said, Dock of the Bay. Wow, man. And the list went on. I said, didn't you get... And he just named about six or seven that he'd written. And you're talking multi-million selling, the greatest pop songs of its period, the Stax stuff, you know. But he wrote for Otis, for heaven's sakes, you know. Brilliantly talented people.
Komponiert Steve Harley seine Songs auf der Gitarre oder auf dem Klavier? Er spielt ja beide Instrumente.
I never stop playing. I wake up playing the guitar. I own dozens of the things. I don't collect them. Ironically, I don't collect them. It's just that I buy them and then I don't know how to get rid of them. My son's in a university and he's got in his university pad, he's got a 2,000 pound, 3,000 guild, 3,000 euro acoustic guild guitar. And I know that he shouldn't have it there, but it's one of my old ones and it's a beautiful instrument. And he was playing a cheap old piece of rubbish. And I said, you cannot play that. Stop it. You need a real guitar. So I lend them to people and they're stuffed under beds and cupboards and behind wardrobes, you know, loads of them. But so that what I've got is an acoustic guitar is set up in any one of about five rooms now in the house, my study, a living room. In the kitchen, there's a big kitchen, and at the back of the kitchen, there's a stand with an old Gibson on it. So I'm playing the guitar all the time. You mustn't let the skin on the tips of your left hand ever get too soft. It's calloused, you know. So I play all the time, and I have a 9-foot concert grand piano in my living room and two upright pianos. So it's everywhere I turn is something to touch, to play, to warm up and practice and just dabble. And sometimes a melody will be picked out. You don't know. It's not you. I mean, Mozart said it, and God knows I'm not him, but you don't know. You sit and you do that with your hand. You dabble. You dabble and you dab and touch and flick and... Somehow something starts to take shape and you say, I don't think I've ever heard that before. I'm having that. I'm having it. It's mine. It's like there is a God and some muse, the muse comes and sits on your shoulder. Just once a week, once a month, once in 6 months, you can go through such periods where I'm flicking away at the piano, playing the guitar and humming, and thinking, no, I've heard it before. Throw it in the bin. I've heard that before. Throw it in the bin. You know, I'm on the mini disc. Erase it because it's been heard before, Steve. Erase it. It's someone else's. Yeah, well, yeah, that never stopped you too. No, it's someone else's. Stop it. I just can't do it. If I think it's someone else's melody, I have to nip it in the bud. I'm ruthless like that. And silly, really, because another week I wake up and three will come in 3 days, one a day. Now, why is that? Oh, they came before. They came 3 months ago when I was desperate, but I didn't notice. I didn't recognize them, or I decided to be callous and throw them in the bin. Today, I won't throw them in the bin. Today, I keep... Who can say? But you don't know what's going to come. But then again, I travel a great deal, as we've said, and notebook and pen always in pocket. I couldn't imagine being without a pen or a notebook. It's just an absurd idea. And I'm writing all the time. So poetry will come or a verse of lyric. And then, you know, you start, go home and play the piano. Well, then the lyrics came first. But another day you're flicking at the piano and a melody comes and you think, oh, wow, oh wow, what's gonna, this is lovely, and I've now got to write words to this. So the answer is every which way, you know? Yeah, any which way. It's you wake up and hope that something happens, because it's what you do.
Gibt es bestimmte Rituale beim Komponieren? Also muss dazu eine bestimmte Stimmung vorhanden sein, eine besondere Situation, Tageszeit oder ähnliches?
A musician will play music when his mood is very high. But then a musician will play music when his mood is very low. It's what we do. You play to improve your temperament, and you play to get out. Yeah, you play. We all do. I mean, I'm not a proper pianist. I wouldn't get in a group playing piano. I wouldn't get in a group playing guitar. I have to run the group in order to work. No, there's no ritual. It's a wing and a prayer, frankly.
Entsteht die Musik gleichzeitig zusammen mit dem Text? Oder ist erst der Text da, der dann vertont wird? Oder ist zuerst die Melodie da, für die dann ein Text gesucht wird?
Well, that is what I'm saying, that you work at the piano or you work on the notebook. It can be either one way or t'other, and then you have to find the other bit, you know, whichever does come first. You're stuck with having to deliver the other half, because I don't like writing with other people. It's a bit difficult.
In einem Interview sagte Steve Harley, ich denke, die meisten Künstler haben, abgesehen von einigen großen Romanautoren, in ihren 20ern und 30ern ihre beste Arbeit schon hinter sich. Ich denke, danach ahmt man sich selbst nur noch nach. Gilt das auch für ihn?
No, I'm not 30, yeah. I wish I hadn't said that. Oh, boy. I think that's when we're at our most fearless, when we don't care what the rules are. So, you know, I was very, the early Cockney Rebel broke a lot of rules. I and those guys simply didn't care what was going on around us. I mean, you can hear it and think there's Bowie and Roxy Music and all the people that were around us at the time, Mott the Hoople. It was a sound of its time. I understand that. But I always felt completely detached from the music business. I never felt part of the music business. Even now, I'm an ex-journalist that writes songs and performs. I don't feel... I do now, actually. I kind of started to feel, because I won an award. The British Academy of Composers and Songwriters gave me a prestigious songwriting award. And it touched me deeply. It's the first prize I've ever won. And I felt suddenly I made a speech. And since then I've presented an award, the Mojo Awards, to Chris Hillman from, yeah. Chris Hillman from the Birds and Flying Burrito Brothers. You know exactly who I mean. And to do that was such a privilege to be asked. I presented an award, a Lifetime's Achievement Award in London to the Rolling Stones, and made a speech. So suddenly the music business is treating me as if I'm kind of part of the furniture. Been around long enough, you know what I mean? And so I'm starting at the age of 53, a couple of years ago, to start to feel that I do belong. So it took a long time. I've always felt that I'm a frustrated painter who does songs instead.
Inwieweit sind die Texte von Steve Harley autobiografisch?
When it's not too obscure, it will be 100%. Certainly The Quality of Mercy, the recently released collection, is as autobiographical as I've ever got. I've always been scared. Most of my canon of work is rather surreal and obscure and based very much in allegory, religious allegory. And it wasn't that I couldn't express myself clearly. I think it was... I just wanted to be mysterious, and it was the way I enjoyed writing a song. You know, I wrote about people around me in the 70s, early records. You know, there's Loretta's Tale on the first album, and it goes off into this mysterious place, and I don't know why. Whereas today on The Quality of Mercy, I wrote for me, I wrote about being a father and being of a certain age, worrying about the future. I don't know. I think a lot about death, which is very, very annoying, very irritating. I want that to go away. I've got to stop that. Got to stop it. I'm very aware of mortality. And here's a man who I get on 75 aeroplanes a year, you know, 100 aeroplanes a year. And I'm scared of death. Well, I'm scared of, the mortality has got me jumpy. When I was up to 40, I was kind of immortal. Never thought, you know, just over 50, I've started to realize, my dad's coming up to 80. And he's an old man. 30 years ain't such a long time, is it, when you... Where the heck does it go? So I don't like that. My problem is that I don't feel as though I've achieved much. And there's so much more to do that I want to achieve.
Haben die Songs des Albums The Quality of Mercy thematisch eine Art von rotem Faden oder so etwas wie ein Leitmotiv?
A lot of the songs are about humility. Even the very mad, aggressive song, The Last Feast, which is 8 verses long of power chords and enormous drum sounds. And that's about little Steve in hospital surviving when they told my mum and dad that I would die. And somehow we pulled through, you know, got lucky, you know, we survived. And the album, if it has a theme at all, whether it's the aggressive Last Feast or A Friend for Life, which is the diametric opposite, it does have a theme of humility.
Die Titelzeile des Albums The Quality of Mercy findet sich im Text des Songs The Coast of Amalfi. Darin wird die atemberaubende Landschaft der amalfitanischen Küste beschrieben. Ein Segelturn von Positano nach Capri wird erwähnt, doch auf die Landschaftsbeschreibung folgt auch immer eine Gefühlsbeschreibung. Immer wieder, an jedem Strophenende, wird das sich wandelnde Gefühl des Ich-Erzählers beschrieben. I was high, I got sad, I got saved on the coast of Amalfi. Wie ist die Zeile The Quality of Mercy hier zu verstehen? Und warum ist diese Zeile so wichtig, dass sie zum Albumtitel erkoren wurde?
I realize how lucky I am to have what little talent I possess. You know, it's enough for me to have a great life. And I'm not ripping anybody off. You know, I'm doing the best I can. But I learned the quality of humility, which Shakespeare's expression, the quality of mercy, obviously from The Merchant of Venice. The quality of mercy is not strained, it is twice blessed. And when Portia says this in court to try to save Bassanio from Shylock, the Jewish moneylender taking his pound of flesh, the heart of Bassanio, and she makes this enormously powerful, powerful speech, the quality of mercy is not strained, it is twice blessed. It's my way of a nod at not Shakes, but it's the expression sums up what I pray for in my own life. And there is a line at the end of The Coast of Amalfi, as you said, you pointed out, where he says, my dream has the quality of mercy. And his dream has all these precious elegance and wonder. And as I wrote it, I was aware that I would sing it on stage and I would be looking at thousands of people and I would be throwing away for the first time in my career of 33 years and 12 or 13 albums, I would be being honest. I would be looking into the audience with my eyes open saying, my dream has this elegance and wonder. My dream has the quality of mercy. And I'd be saying to them in all truth, have I got it really? But or is it, it's my dream. And you're looking at the world thinking, well, you tell me if I've got it. Because you never know with yourself. You look in the mirror and you just hope you're not a bad guy. But you don't really know. Otherwise, why does a monk pray for 30 years, 5 times a day? Why does my vicar take funerals and speak sermons at funerals of children and say, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, if there's a God, where is he? Well, let me tell you, there is a God and he's here to help you over. I've heard this at a young child's funeral. And, you know, it's humility. You learn that you've got a talent, a gift, or whatever. Mine's not a gift. Mozart was gifted. I've just got a little bit of something, you know. And you use it to the best of your ability. But the trick is to look in the mirror always, to come away, going on stage. I always want to go on stage saying, whatever happens up there, show humility. You know, what you're doing ain't so big. And if people love you, don't take it too seriously, boy. You got to do it again tomorrow night.
Im Song Journey's End, A Father's Promise, scheint Steve Harley eines seiner eigenen Kinder anzusprechen. Ist der Eindruck richtig?
I wrote it for my children. There's two of them. But my son is always in my mind. I can't tell you why. My daughter knows this. He's got something about him, something he glows. And my daughter knows that it was... that my son Care was who I was writing about. But I said to her, it is about being a father. And she just shrugs, who cares? He says, I want the new Westlife album. Yeah, it was the first time that I've written about such domestic issues. I mean, you don't, do you really? It's kind of like yawn. But I tried to sort of say words that would touch the average buyer of my music, the average listener would say, yeah, I've got one of those, you know, but I'm very forthright in that song. I've tried to write it as though I was speaking in conversation to a 21, 22 year old. Because he says in there, hold on to adolescent dreams, stay free and open. Yeah, he says, life's hand is rarely what it seems, so don't let it bring you heartache. And yeah, it is that he's saying wherever happens, you are watching over your children. My mum will tell me, you know, she's 78, but I'm a little boy. You know, my dad still wants to lend me £10. You know, I see him, it was 15 euros. Hey, you all right, boy? You okay, boy? You all right, son? Yeah, I'm all right. He's trying to lend me money. Oh, please.
Geht es im Song The Last Goodbye um eine selbst erlebte Trennung?
Oh no, The Last Goodbye is, that's a very sad story about my daughter. I upset her badly one night by lecturing her. She wasn't working hard enough and she was mixing with one or two of the wrong people in my wife's opinion. Mine too, but I'm blaming my wife in public, if you don't mind. It sounds so snobbish. But my daughter, yeah, and it was going all wrong. And we weren't going to stand for that. I don't wait until it festers. I nip it in the... I stop. There's a problem? Stop the problem. You're sick? Get better. Own up to it. It won't go away. You don't close your eyes and wake up and it's gone. It's not going unless you sort it. So we fell out for a little while. And no, I've written it about her. It's this little conversation. I know it sounds very adult. It sounds like a woman. And she was 18 years old, but still my little baby. No, he says, what? I don't know. He says something about the chorus is, show me a life's compassion. Spare us the last goodbye. You know, and I do try to teach them. Again, compassion, humility, courtesy, all that stuff. No, that's what it was about.
Würde Steve Harley zustimmen, wenn man feststellt, dass er heute sehr viel besser und intonationssicherer singt als früher in seinen erfolgreichsten Zeiten mit Cockney Rebel?
What are you saying? What was wrong? Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I sing a lot. You know, a lot. As we get older, our voices do drop. We drop, like you guys, the presenters, broadcasters, professionals, you talk, and as you get older, your lungs expand, apparently. And, well, mine has dropped about, I can sing two semitones lower and three or four semitones higher than I could in the 70s. Partly, I have to say, partly it's the work and the warm-ups that I do. But I learned how to sing properly from the diaphragm so that I can keep singing every night for touring, you know, not from the throat. I learned all that in 1986 when I was the first Phantom of the Opera. You know, I was the first Phantom. I didn't do it on stage. Eventually, Michael Crawford did it in England. They ousted me at the last minute. It didn't bother me. I wanted, sued for breach of contract. And I really wanted to get back onto my own stage, not Lloyd Webber's dressing room, my dressing room. I didn't want to sing Music of the Night. Not really, but I did. I sang it with the orchestra before Crawford. Well, what I got out of that was a few months of being Phantom with him. I went to singing lessons with one of London's most difficult to get to see singing teachers. Lloyd Webber can open the doors, you know what I mean? And I carry my warm-ups on a mini disc now to this day, which I do every day of my life. I try and have them not do it when I'm having a real break, but so I did learn to sing a bit, yeah. It means a lot to me because I do so much of it on tour. I want every night to be the best I can give. It scares me so much to be, I won't go around anyone with a cold, the C word. I just smell it from 10 meters and go, whoa, out of here. You think Michael Jackson's wacky? We're all like it. Shaking hands, looking at people. Are you breathing on me with your germs? You know what I mean? We are all like it. You have, it's the instrument, the voice. I have to walk out there and sing. You can't be around smoke, colds, germs, air conditioning, too much heat. Oh, God. The life of a singer on the road is, it's tough. I gotta tell you, you don't want to know. It's hard.
Ich persönlich hatte mit manchen Songs aus den 70er Jahren vor allem deswegen Probleme, weil der Sänger Steve Harley beim Singen die Töne nicht exakt stimmig getroffen hat. Ob bei Judy Teen oder Hideaway oder I Believe Love's a Prima Donna oder selbst bei Make Me Smile sind einige Gesangstöne flat, also leicht schief. Das heißt, für mich so sehr schief, unsauber, manchmal sogar falsch, dass ich die Songs nur wegen dieser unsauberen Gesangstöne nicht gerne gehört habe. Ich rede hier nicht von den bewussten Tonverschleifungen à la Bob Dylan oder Janis Joplin. Wollte Steve Harley dies damals genauso haben? Oder war es ihm egal, ob mal ein Ton richtig getroffen war oder nicht, weil es ihm vielleicht nur um den authentischen Ausdruck ging? Oder hat er das damals einfach nicht gehört, dass er manchmal nicht sauberstimmig gesungen hat? Denn das Album The Quality of Mercy ist auch gesanglich perfekt produziert. Da stimmt jeder Gesangston und früher war das nicht immer so.
Certainly in the 70s, I can picture Abbey Road year in, year out. You know, we made an album every year then. And I can picture myself now walking up to the microphone with Alan Parsons as my engineer. And shouting at the mic for about 5 minutes and saying, that's it, I'm going home now. And he'd say, well, look, you know, oh, all right then. Another take, oh, okay. What's wrong with that then? You know, and he'd say, well, you know, you've got to get it, you know, not perfect, but better. Oh, okay. So again, a slightly arrogant attitude, but also I bore easily. My attention span wanders, you know, I want to do other things and perfection ain't my bag. Perfection ain't for me. I like rough edges. I like a sense that someone has delivered what's in their heart and not singing like a machine. But certainly I take a lot more care now than I used to. Yes, I can. I have to admit it.
Das Album The Quality of Mercy enthält viele beeindruckende Songs und zwei besonders starke, nämlich The Last Feast und A Friend for Life. Was sind aus seiner Sicht die besonderen Merkmale dieser beiden Songs?
Well, The Last Feast is produced as a big power chord, as I said earlier, a big power chord thrash of 8 verses, but it is the life of little Steve getting out of hospital and moving all the time. I'm always running. Some journalist said to me recently about The Last Feast, he said in England, what is it you're running away from? And I said, I didn't know. I didn't realize that I was. I'm actually running towards something. There's quite a big difference, my friend. Sounding glib. But A Friend for Life could only have been written by a man in his 50s, you know, or 40s anyway. You couldn't write it at 25. I couldn't have written it when I was a young man because we talk about the kids leave for breeding. We worry. It's a song worrying about, you know, the relationship with a wife when there are no kids around anymore, when you're alone, you know. It's also the first time I got that personal in a song, that really in your face, when he says, I'll paint walls, I'll bring you coffee and I'll paint walls and I'll be your one night stand. You know, it's very sexy to say that to a woman as you get older. Let me be your one night stand, you know. Oh, go away. Get off. The trouble with marriage is, of course, if you've got one of us that's highly, highly romantic like me, the chances of another one of the partners being highly romantic is so slim.
Abschließende Frage. Gibt es in seinem Privatleben besondere Leidenschaften jenseits der Musik?
Horse racing. My great therapy. When I'm not away looking at buildings and museums and social history, which is my love, my first hobby, my great passion is the world of horse racing. I've owned a lot of racehorses. I don't at the moment sitting here, I own no racehorses, but next week I could buy into another one next week. My friends are professionals. They just call up and say, look, we've got this. Are you interested? And I'll go and see it and talk it through and ask about the money and, you know, who's going to train it. And I go racing. I'm an annual member. I have a badge for Newmarket, which is the headquarters of flat racing in the UK. So that's my great passion. And I meet really interesting people, professional gamblers, betting men generally, the bookmakers who take the bets, you know, racing people, jockeys. They all know me and they all talk to me. The problem is they all come up to me at the races. They all know me and I'm often on the TV talking about racing. And if they get the cameras, are always at the races. And these guys all want to talk to me about music. It's always like, you know, hey, I see you're playing London Shepherd's Bush in December and they're after a couple of tickets, you know. Oh, I see you're playing My Town and I heard you on the radio the other day. What's that song all about? And I'm standing there saying, never mind that. Tell me what's going to win the 230. For Christ's sakes, you know, I want to have a bet. Stop talking music. Talk racing. This is a race course. So that's one of my passions. And I read a lot. I read a lot of books. I read voraciously.
Soweit die Aufzeichnung des Interviews mit Steve Harley vom September 2006. Er stand damals kurz vor einer 9 Konzerte umfassenden Clubtour durch Deutschland mit seiner Band. Im Gepäck hatte er sein damals aktuelles ausgezeichnetes Album The Quality of Mercy. Natürlich hatte ich mich damals bei Steve Harley sehr herzlich zu bedanken für all seine lebendigen Schilderungen im Interview.
My pleasure, thank you. Dankeschön. Tschüss.